Let's have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It's 1:33 in the afternoon of January 18th, 2012. It's the first Judiciary Committee meeting of this second year in the legislative, in the 27th legislature. And welcome. Nice to have you all here. Thanks for coming. My name is Hollis French. I'm the chairman. We are also have Senator Joe Pascrean here, Senator Bill Walkowski, and Senator Coghill. Senator McGuire is running a few minutes late, but I understand that she's going to be here. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We've got two bills on the calendar today, SB 104, Manufactured Homes, and SB 89, Legislative Ethics Act. It's my hope to bring up SB 104 and to move the bill. We're going to hear and hold SB 89. So let's turn first to SB 104. It's a bill that I have sponsored. It is in its third hearing here in the Judiciary Committee, and it's a big bill. It's a complicated bill, but it's also basically a simple bill that allows for people who own trailer homes to convert them into real property. For many, many years, we have treated trailer homes as just that, more as a car than anything else, and yet people who affix them to their property in a permanent fashion will benefit if they can be treated as real property. You get all the benefits of home ownership, better mortgage interest rates, and so forth. And the bill is designed to allow that to happen. But because you touch on DMV, because you touch on the recorder's office, which is in the Department of Natural Resources, and because you're dealing with the banking industry, what is a very simple concept turns into a 20-some-odd page bill with lots of provisions. So members should not feel bad if you don't feel like you're completely up to speed on it, but we will spend a few minutes today on the bill, refreshing our recollections and so forth. The first thing we have to do is to formally adopt the CS we have in front of us, which is backslash D. Mr. Vice Chair.
Chair, I would move that we adopt CS for Senate Bill number 104, version backslash D.
Is there objection?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator,
do I need? Are we going to go through the bill?
We will talk about the bill to your satisfaction.
All right,
to the committee satisfaction.
No objection to it. I just wanted to make sure some of the differences between this and the previous version.
Absolutely.
I think it's just an effective date, if I remember.
We'll get to that, but let's just go ahead and if there's no objection,
right,
the backslash D is before us. I will go through the memo that was prepared for this CS. I still have a copy of it. It's dated April 14th, 2011, and this CS does a few things from the previous bill, and I'm going to let you know what they are. The principal changes are in Section 27. The changes to Section 27 are as follows. Section 27 you will find on page, I'm going to say
20.
Thank you, Senator Pascrean. That is correct. There it is, Section 27. And it's about recording the affidavits related to manufactured homes. They modified 4017-125A was modified so that the recorder's office won't have to determine whether the affixation or severance affidavit meets the requirements under 3485. The recorder's office basically doesn't want to be in the position of determining whether the contents of a document are legally sufficient to achieve the purposes of the document. Instead, as clarified under regulation, the person submitting the documents for recording must ensure that the prerequisites for recording as established by regulation and statute are met. That's one change. There's two minor changes also to 4017-125B, which is also on page 20 and spills over into 21. The first modifies the action taken by the recorder on the recording affidavit, changing the word right to the word place on page 20, line 30. The change reflects that the recording office no longer writes on recorded affidavits. Instead, they affix barcodes. It's just part of the change in how the industry operates. The barcodes contain the relevant information, so the verb is place instead of write. In addition, the original draft required an affidavit to be recorded in land records, but in 4017-125B changes in land records to the public record to match where the recorder actually files land records today. Finally, 4017-125C in the original version was removed in this CS. This language required the recorder's office to automatically send a certified copy of the recorded affidavit to a person designated in an affidavit. This doesn't match current recording. procedures which require an individual to request and pay for certified copies of affidavits. So those are the main changes, with one final one in Section 16 of the legislation, which is on page, looks like 11. No, I'm sorry. On page, it's a lengthy section.
Six.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Page 6, 16 begins and spilled over several pages. In Section 16, the original draft required DMV to notify a primary lien holder of completed conversion procedures in instances where the conversion involved canceling a manufacturer's certificate of origin or title. Yet under Section 2810.267 of this legislation, a conversion cannot take place until a manufactured home is free and clear of all liens and encumbrances. Because a primary lien holder would never exist through a conversion procedure, the lien holder notification provisions were replaced in the CS with language that allows the applicant to indicate one person, in addition to the owner, that receives written acknowledgement of completed conversions. And that change is reflected in 2810.262C, in 263C, 264D, 265C, and 266 sub 12 of the CS version. And those are the changes. And just while you're contemplating that mouthful, I will let you know that we have online George Ginsburg, who is an attorney for Wells Fargo. We have Patrick Green, who is also with Wells Fargo. We have Whitney Brewster, who's the DMV director, Vicky Bacchus, who's from the State Recorder's Office, and Colleen Moore from the Alaska Attorney General's Office. I appreciate all of them being available. And I think Mr. Ginsburg is down as wanting to testify. Let's turn to him and see if that's true. Mr. Ginsburg, are you there?
Hello?
We can hear you.
Yes, I'm here, Senator, but I had not, frankly, intended to testify, but I'm here to answer questions concerning the legislation that the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Ginsburg. We frequently get a little... We just get a little yes or no next to your name here, and sometimes those indicators are a little bit off. So we've got you down to answer questions. Thank you for making yourself available.
My pleasure.
While we have the bill in front of us, I have an let me just ask then, actually, we've run through this list of folks. Is there anyone else online who wants to testify about this SB 104? Anyone in the room who'd like to testify about it? You can see that I'm going to close public testimony on the bill. We've adopted backslash B, and I have one amendment that's basically a cleanup amendment that you should have. The amendment essentially brings the bill up to date since it's been held over 1 year. Some of the dates are now anachronisms and they need to be modified. The amendment, which I'll style number one by myself, I will move the amendment, and I'll object to it at the same time, so it's before us for discussion purposes. And if you'll turn to page 21, that's where the bulk of this work is done. Page 21, on line 22, you'll see that the regulations would take effect January 1, 2012. That's obviously passed. That's replaced with 2013. On line 26, same thing. You know, the law's got to, we're going to put it in place for 2013. And finally, on page, same page, 21, line 29, the effective date would be next year, first of the year. So any other discussion regarding the amendment? Hearing and seeing none, I'll remove my objection to ask if there's further objection. Hearing and seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. And that brings the bill back before us. As I say, it is not a small bill, but it's has a simple purpose. The bill has been looked over by the State Affairs Committee, by the Judiciary Committee now in the third hearing, and I pointed out, I think, to Senator Pascvan as the hearing was kicking off, we've got letters of support from not only Wells Fargo, who is the entity that brought the bill to me, but also from the Alaska Bankers Association, which is a banking association made up of Alaska Pacific Bank, Denali State Bank, First Bank of Ketchikan, First National Bank of Alaska, Key Bank, Mount McKinley Bank, Northrim Bank, you know, a lot of local banks, not just the larger Wells Fargo. And that letter signed by Joe Beadle, who we all know from Commonwealth North, and who was, I would say, Well, he's cautious. Let's just say he's a cautious person. So I think that's of some comfort. Senator Wilkowski?
Ready for a motion?
I'm ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move CS for Senate Bill number 104, version backslash D, as amended, on to the next committee of referral.
With individual recommendations, any attached fiscal note?
Yes.
Attached bureau fiscal note. Is there objection to the motion?
Can I speak to it?
I would just make a comment, if I could.
Please, yeah, and then Senator Wilkowski.
Certainly. You know, I'm going to vote for this bill because I think it's important to give people at the economic strata that are purchasing mobile homes the opportunity to purchase those mobile homes at a lower interest rate, and we are relying upon the private market to determine whether they qualify for that loan. My concern has always been with the fact that the now that investment banking and commercial banking are not separated, that the banks that will loan this, make the loan to the people, then sell these loans to others, and that's out on the financial markets. And again, it's not, this bill is not the place to address that. But again, the you know, we came through a situation that nearly crushed the entire world's economic system in 2008, which deals in part with bundling of mortgages, selling those mortgages, and then those mortgages are upside down, and the whole issue of derivatives, again, that's at the higher level than the individual that's going and seeking a loan at a low interest rate. And again, I think it's good for Alaskans that they have the opportunity to obtain those low interest rate loans, but again, I'm just putting my position on the record that when it comes to the selling of these loans and the bundling of them, I think we need to get back to Glass-Steagall. That's the short answer. So,
thank you, Senator Passman. Senator Wilkowski.
I think Senator Passman makes some great points. I would agree with those statements. As for the bill itself, I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for bringing this bill forward. I probably have more mobile homes, manufactured homes in my district, probably than any other district in the state, I would venture to say. And this is really going to have an impact on the quality of life of the people in my district and all across the state of Alaska, because what it's going to do is it's going to allow them to get lower-cost mortgages for their manufactured homes, for their mobile homes. It'll allow more Alaskans to achieve the desire of most Americans and most Alaskans, which is to own a home, to own your own little piece of property and have your own home. So I support this. I think it will provide a host of other advantages to people that you get through home ownership, advantages in stronger protections for heirs, other legal advantages that people get when for personal home ownership as opposed to personal property. So I'm very happy to support this bill. It's a complex bill, but it will have a real impact on Alaskans' lives, I think.
Thank you. Senator Coghill, anything you want to add?
Well, you know, thank you for bringing it forward. I once again, probably don't have as many manufactured homes, but along Richardson Highway, many people have pulled in and put a foundation under and found themselves not able to call it a home. They had to call it a vehicle. So, yes, I think this answered that question. The concept is simple, as you said. And I was amazed at how many people were plugged into the issue.
Right.
I'm grateful. I think we got a good fix, so thank you.
There's a motion before the body to move the bill out of committee. Is there objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the bill's moved. We'll go ahead and sign the paperwork, take a short at ease, and we'll come right back with Senator Coghill's ethics bill. back on the record now, and turning to SB 89. We left off last year after having had a brief overview of the bill and with an amendment, T.1, that was moved and objected to. That's the procedural landscape we find ourselves in. We do have version T before us, but I think amendment T.1 had not yet been adopted. And maybe before we get to a vote on T1, I will turn to the sponsor, ask him to refresh our recollection on this bill. It's another good-sized piece of legislation with a lot of different moving parts, and maybe bring us up to speed on it. And then we'll turn and have in the audience both our friend Joyce from the Ethics Office, but also Dan Wayne from Ledge Legal is on the line to answer questions. Senator Cogburn.
Mr. Chairman, there's a couple ways I could proceed. I could actually go through the verbiage of the bill, through the sectional, if you wish.
I think that would be good.
Just, you want me to go through the sectional?
Yes.
All right. Which I'll do. I guess the context that I'd like to keep reminding people is this bill deals with our standards of conduct. It's in Article 2 of the Standards of Conduct. And Section 1 starts off the question on what is, or actually under the heading of prohibited conduct and conflicts of interest. So I'm going to flip back and forth between the bill and the sectional so that I can remember some of my notes. Section 1 adds a compassionate gift language, kind of clarifies language of the difference between a gift instead of calling it a lawful gratuity, and then adds the section 2460.075, which deals with, I think, the definition of gifts. So, so Section 1, lawful gratuity, makes a section consistent with usage of gift. Section number 2, and I'll come back to that. Section number 2 is the conduct conflict of interest statute. Once again, it's drawn what I think is a brighter line for legislators and staff actively involved in constituent problems, and we've dealt with this from time to time on how far we can go. But the real question is, once something gets into an administrative hearing, how far can you go? So I think what we've done is come up with three things that you can do. Certainly, if you are representing them for compensation, that's legitimate. Sitting on a panel of lawyers, I think you can understand that. And acting as a witness on an issue, if you are knowledgeable to be called as a witness. And then in the legislature, we are quite often talking to people. There may be some inadvertent contact. So once something is before a hearing officer, it's very clear you have these three things that that you can do, and beyond that, you're off bounds. So section number 3 eliminates the requirement of the committee to compile its list of financial disclosures. It's kind of a housekeeping issue. Rather than creating a list, we just turn it over to the clerks for them publishing it in our records. So the chief clerk of the House and Senate will get those. It's a way of making them a public record without making a lot of compilation issues for the ethics staff. Section number 4 adds public members to the statute prohibiting disclosure of confidential information, which I personally think was an oversight and which was brought to me by the Ethics Committee. The legislators are under the confidential requirement. The public members have not been to date.
And this is specific to that one Ethics Committee?
Right.
It's not that, because there's lots of committees that have public and private member, public and legislative members, but it's just...
This is only dealing with that specific committee, yes. Okay. Thank you. So let's see, where am I at here? Section number 5 starts talking about charity events with lobbyists, clarifies that a ticket to a charity event from a lobbyist or gift received because of a ticket cannot exceed $250. It's, I think, more clarification than anything. So... and part of that is cleanup language. So,
maybe and do you know, or maybe I should ask Joyce, but is that like a bright line, a $250 cutoff, that is, you just can never exceed that amount? I'm getting a head nod. The record shall reflect that Ms. Anderson has nodded her head.
Yes. So up to $249.99.
Okay.
That's the way I see it.
In the aggregate.
For a year, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Calendar year, aggregate, yep. Thank you.
However, there are places where gifts are going to be allowed, and they're just expressly not for lobbyists, but will be recorded, and we'll get to that section. So section number six we're at. So section number six is, let me flip over here real quick, specifies the gifts from charitable events. And on page 9 is where that addition comes in. We printed pretty much the whole language of that section, but on page 9, sub 10 on lines 15 and 16, a ticket to a charitable event or a gift in connection with a charity event. So this specifies a gift from charitable events. By clarifying, it could be a ticket to a charity event or a gift in connection with a charity event. Number 7 extends the reporting period of gifts of travel for the purpose of obtaining information, also to charitable events, from 30 to 60 days. And you'll see that in a couple of places. It also includes the reference to that ticket to charity event, as you'll see on line 30, C10. And on page 10, line 2, that reference is again in there. So section number 8 is under exceptions to disclose by written request. One of the questions that we've had is if somebody is giving a service to somebody in the legislature and for some reason there is a barrier to that, either by a professional or some legal reason. So, and I think the language is actually broadened in the state affairs to include a rule adopted formally by a trade or profession that a state or federal law requires a person to follow. I guess one of the incidents came to the ethics committee that somebody was actually giving some health care to somebody, and there was money changing hands, and was it ethically reported? And under that case, that health care was confidential information. So that was one case. And then I think with you as lawyers, you'll understand that there's sometimes the privilege of a client can be confidential under certain circumstances. However, it has that requirement that somebody explain it. And so you'll see here, at the request of a committee or person authorized to act on behalf of a person who seeks to refrain from making a disclosure under this section shall provide committee with justification in writing. So I think it holds an accountability both ways. So applicability, section 9, when a volunteer, when they're required to take a ethics course, we have so many volunteers now that if they are using state resources, computers, access to office information, that they are required to view how the ethics laws are, so we require them to take that course. And so that will be under section 11. And I think there's one other place that we take care of it. Section 10 is pretty much a site.
Just a question on that. Sure. Section, Senator Coghill, section 9, what's the penalty for violating? Well, what happens to an intern or a volunteer who doesn't get the training, works more than 30 days, it gets reported? That's in the hands of the Ethics Committee?
And what we've been doing at this point is it gets reported to the Ethics Committee, and they go to the presiding officers. And so the way I understand it, the presiding officers would decide whether they can or cannot proceed. Beyond that, I'd have to ask Joyce Anderson.
Okay. Has it come up, Joyce? You should come forward. Thanks. Put yourself on the record. Welcome to the committee. Nice to have you here. First time. Well, it'll be nice to you, really, really nice to you the first time, and then after this, you know how it goes.
I'll remember that. Joyce Anderson, Administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. Mr. Chair and committee members, there really is no penalty in statute if someone doesn't complete ethics training, but as Senator Coghill has said, our policy has been that we would contact either the, first of all, we would contact the senator or legislator who has hired the individual and then go to the presiding officers and let them know, and then they would put some pressure on that individual to attend training.
Okay.
power of persuasion.
Yes.
That seems reasonable to me. Thank you. Thank you,
Ms. Would you like me to just stay here?
Yeah. I probably have more questions.
So Section 10 and 11 are really the insertion of the citation of 2460-131, which deals with the alternate members in Section 12. So you'll see the citation involved there. And Section 12 talks about alternate members, adds the alternate public member. And that comes to the question of when a committee is meeting and a public member cannot make it, there is at this point no provision for an alternate. You may very well end up where you're not able to get the quorum necessary to conduct a meeting because of a public member. And the legislators can have alternates. This is just putting us in a place where we can have public alternates.
I see. And is it roughly parallel to the legislative alternate statute?
I'm sorry, say that again.
This is for putting alternate public members on. Is the procedure similar to the procedure for putting alternate legislative
members on? No, it is members not. On? Maybe I can have Joyce explain. One is done by the legislature, one is done by the court system.
Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we're asking for, this is an ethics committee recommendation, we're asking for one alternate member, not alternates for all five public members. And the public members on the committee are appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and then confirmed by the legislature. But the service of the alternate member would be similar to the service of the alternate member for a legislator.
Would the alternate be also confirmed?
Yes, the alternate would be confirmed as well, yes.
So he's a sort of a officially designated alternate?
Yes.
But he or she's not going to shadow every meeting, they're just going to be summoned when time requires.
Exactly.
I see.
However, Mr. Chairman, if you look on line 21 and 22 of page 12, once that member begins the discussion, and once the member is designated to participate, then they would stay through the duration of that particular issue. I think that's something that will help the continuity of discussion.
Makes sense. Thank you.
So Section 13 deals with legislative disclosure, the course, I'm sorry, adds volunteers serving more than 30 days to take the ethics course, basically. So that is the citation that I was talking about previously. And then Section 14 deals with definitions, which is always tricky business, except for this one, it's fairly simple. We took those who are generally on a list of exceptions, and we took them and put them under who are hourly employees and perform functions that are incidental to legislative functions. Rather than having a long list, that would be kind of the line that we would draw. So that's primarily where we're at. It's pretty much, I'd say, operational kind of house cleaning type until you get to my amendment.
Okay, let's just hold that thought for a second, and let me ask about Section 14. Are gavel-to-gavel cam operators legislative employees?
They don't even work for the legislature.
Okay. Yeah, they're employed by the city of Juneau. I mean, that's where the money, okay. Just curious.
And a great benefit.
Well, we're very lucky, very lucky. And before we get to the amendment, let's back up to Section 2, page 5, dealing with our ability to help our constituents in matters that may be in front of a administrative hearing. There's nothing in this provision that prohibits a legislator from talking to the agency about a timeline or about when the next hearing is, or what the sort of procedural status of the case is. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, to my knowledge, no.
Ms. Anderson, you do agree?
That's correct.
Okay.
You can certainly call for case status information.
When's the next hearing?
Exactly.
Right, right. It's when I call up and say, you know, look, you got to say yes on this, or you got to say no on this. That's when I get into trouble.
Correct, Mr. Chair. And also, this statute does not allow you to call the hearing officer. You know, he or she, you cannot call them and talk to them about the case. You have to talk to someone in the office about the case.
Okay. Any further questions about this section?
Mr. Chairman, there is one portion that maybe we could have Dan Wayne speak to before we get to the
amendment.
Amendment.
Sure.
That is on page 13 of the bill. brought to my attention as we walked in the door. So it's a question that I don't know the answer to. In Section F on line 2, page 13, designation under C to E of this section is a confidential proceeding under 2460-170L, unless the member who is replaced as a result of the designation waives confidentiality. I was asked what the meaning of that was.
Right.
Quite frankly, I didn't have an answer to it.
Mr. Wayne, are you on the line?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
We sure can. And did you hear the question?
I think so. This is Dan Wayne, legislative legal. There's a, if you look on page 12, line, let's see, I'm sorry. I think what it's talking about is in a case where a regular member of the committee is disqualified.
A regular public member, no?
Or a regular or a legislative public member.
Any member, okay.
Yes, any member is disqualified from serving in a proceeding under 2460-170, which would be a complaint proceeding. Then I think what it's intended to do is to prevent speculation about the reason for why that person has been replaced with an alternate. For example, if a public member of the committee was subject to an ethics complaint and had to leave that proceeding and be replaced by an alternate, the fact that they were replaced by an alternate could put a dent in the secrecy of the proceedings.
Do ethics complaints come against public members?
They can.
Okay.
If they're covered by, if it's a section of the Ethics Act that covers them.
Okay. And just sure. We'll stop and recognize Senator McGuire. Just joined us, and we are in the middle of a discussion of Senator Coghill's ethics bill, SB 89.
Okay.
And so go ahead, but I mean, Ms. Anderson, something you wanted to add?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I could. If you, the current statute right now under 2460-130N, the very last sentence states, and that would not be in your bill, but it would be in the statute, states the designation shall be treated as confidential to the same extent that the identity of the subject of a complaint is required to be kept confidential. So I'm not sure why we're changing that at this point. Because, you know, a complaint is confidential. A person can recuse themselves for a variety of reasons. Let's say they're, as we mentioned earlier, they're unable to attend or they have a conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not quite sure what the intent was for putting this in there, that the member who is, let's say, not is waiving or is not able to attend the meeting would waive confidentiality. What does that mean? Does that person mean they can say I'm waiving it because, and then that would take away the confidentiality of the reason why they're waiving it? I guess I don't understand.
Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can give a scenario. Let's say I am now a sitting member on the Ethics Committee. If a complaint was given against me and I was asked to be excused from the committee, and I had a reporter ask me, at that point, is it my right to speak about a complaint against me? And would this give me the right to recuse that confidentiality, waive that confidentiality?
Of the fact that you're replaced.
So maybe Mr. Wayne can answer that scenario.
Mr. Wayne?
Well, first I would point out that the final section of this bill repeals 2460-130N. So the language that Ms. Anderson was referring to would be repealed. So this basically sort of replaces that. It's another way of saying that the confidentiality of provisions that require the identity of the subject of a complaint to be kept confidential would also apply to keeping confidential the appointment of an alternate, the identity of the alternate. So, and that confidentiality is created under 2460-170L. Proceedings of the committee related to complaints before are confidential. So I don't know if that's helpful, but
I think I have a grip on it. We keep confidential to the same degree that we keep complaints confidential. We keep the replacement of a member confidential.
Yes, in essence. But all, and all the language that Senator Coghill was asking about is essentially a replacement of the last sentence of N in our 2460-130N that's being repealed. So it's just keeping that under the new section in the bill.
Okay. I mean, all of 130N is repealed, just so we're clear, right?
Right.
Right. Okay. Okay, I it's a little opaque. I don't think it happens very often, but I think I have a handle on what's going on. Ms. Anderson, more thoughts?
I guess I'm not sure. I understand, Mr. Chair and committee members, I understand, Representative, I'm sorry, I still call you Representative, Senator Coghill, your comment about, let's say, the complaint was against you, and then you could waive confidentiality. We have another part of the statute that says if a person that has a complaint against them has the option to waive confidentiality, and if they don't and they say they have a complaint against them, then the complaint is dismissed. So I guess we could look back to that particular section and work it into this one. I'm still a little confused, but I'll go with the committee.
Senator Coghill. Mr. Chairman, maybe I missed it, but after looking at 2460-170, the original language in N and this, I get confused. So, and I'm supposed to carry this.
You are. So we can say this is the point that we'll
get. Point I have to work
for
on.
For the clarification.
Right.
Okay, we'll just put it down.
Because the word unless really throws you into another category that I don't understand. And so I'm going to do some homework on this.
Okay.
I knew your intention was not to move the bill yet today anyway. So I will certainly work on it, see if I can make that more clear than it is.
Okay. It's flagged, and thank you. That brings us, I think, to your amendment, T1. If we've covered the bill and gone over it, remind us what T1 does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this was it's a little hotter issue. Most of the other stuff in this bill is really...
Oh, this is the travel.
Make it work. This is the travel issue if you're on state participation. So let me just, I know the bill is, the amendment's before us, but I'll tell what the two sections of this amendment do, my rationale, and then we can see how to handle it. But my intention to do this is to seek, you know, as sharp a minds as I can get on this to see if there's any way to talk about solving really an issue that has been going on since really in the early 90s, I think, is the question. So there's two sections that this deals with, which is 030 and 031. One of the sections is the very bill that we're talking about under conduct, behavior conduct. 3.1 talks about what you can do during fundraising. So those are the two issues. The language is exactly the same in both sections. So the question that this amendment asks is, if somebody's on state travel, can they do any political activity anytime, anywhere? And right now, the way our statutes are, it really closes that down and says, no, you cannot. It's what I would consider a strict prohibition. And the legislators down through the years and the Legislative Ethics Committee down through the years have continually bounced this around, sent it to the legislature asking a question. And I know it's a little bit of a lightning rod because of the ethical cloud we just kind of passed through, but it's still, to me, a very legitimate question. Let me just give a scenario for those who are listening and a refresher to you who are sitting here. If you live in Anchorage and you're a legislator, you can go do legislative business for 2 hours in a day, and you can go do political activity for any of the rest of the day. You can do fundraising, you can do house calling, you can do it all. If I want to see a commissioner, I have to fly to Juneau, or I have to fly to Anchorage, or drive. Yeah. And if I want to do it on state business, I like to get reimbursed for it. If I go to Anchorage and go to a Republican lunch where I talk very political, that is strictly prohibited. If I go to a fundraiser, that is strictly prohibited. If I go and I get in a rally somewhere that is strictly partisan in nature, I am in violation. Those alongside me can go do the same political work. They can go to all these political activities. Everybody outside of the Anchorage area is strictly prohibited. Everybody in the Anchorage area is strictly okay. So in a matter of fairness, I'm asking the question, when is it unethical for a politician to be a politician, and when is it fair for a somebody who's really got the public trust to maintain that public trust? So I'm trying to find, where do you balance that? So here's what I did in the amendment. I said that it's okay to do partisan activity under these conditions. And if you look on the amendment on page 1, lines 11 through 22, I will give you the three things that I think are fair to ask to say these are things you can do and things you can't do. So, may participate in partisan political activity, including campaign activity, if, so here are the ifs, the participation is incidental to the purpose of travel, the legislator or the legislative employee does not use or authorize the use of state resources to pay for the activity, and the legislator does not participate in the activity under these conditions during normal working days, 8 to 5, except for lunches, or where it says here, excluding meal breaks, on state and municipal election day, or 30 days immediately preceding the any campaign or any election, right? And then this strict prohibition by fundraising for a political party or campaign. So I thought, you have this prohibition. You can't go out and raise money any time while you're straddling on state dime. Though those next to you can. But I still think the state dollar, the public trust, says, no, don't go campaigning for fundraising. But you can still pass a button to somebody and say, hey, vote for me, because I might be meeting you in my district. But you can't do that 30 days prior to an election if you're on state travel, because the public trust is so important. You can't do it on a municipal election day because that has the area of misuse of the trust by participation in an election. So, and the normal work day, I thought, would probably be the better thing to say because if you're going on state travel to do something, it may be that it only takes you a half a day to do it. And I can tell you many times for myself, I fly to Anchorage many times to go see somebody. I have to catch a plane by 4:30 if I'm going to have any activity back at home. Otherwise, I have to wait until the 1 o'clock in the morning flight. So I think they have a plane at 8 o'clock now, but during the wintertime, it doesn't happen. So, you know, most of us would be precluded from that anyway, but at least saying the normal work day, except for maybe if you go to Republican lunch or Democrat lunch or an Independence Party lunch, that would be acceptable. And then it has to be incidental. It can't be planned around that. And so I think people could be accountable. If it looks like I was planning something, you could drag me before the Ethics Committee and say, look, you planned that. It was so obvious. Come on. And hold them to an ethical violation. So I think they're fairly good criteria that I kind of tried to hammer out. However, I'm open to discussion. And so I wanted the amendment to come before you because it really does fall out to kind of the urban-rural divide in Alaska. And this is one way of bridging it, saying we recognize it, that the legislators in the Anchorage Bowl that have pretty much all the government agencies there, all the commissioners, the state building, and yet, if I go right across to the Denai Center, you can go to the Democrat meeting. I can't. And so there's...
You can come to a Democratic meeting.
Yeah, I don't know what the conversion ratio would be there. We'll see. We'll see. But you get the point. You're going to be working right alongside colleagues who can go and do that and really put you at a fair disadvantage because of that. Notwithstanding that, I think there needs to be good rules. And I think anytime you mix money with that, that means it should be a strict prohibition. And I know one of the issues has been people want to come up here to Anchorage and do fundraising and do some state work. And I say, go ahead, but do it on your own dime. But if you're on the state dime and you're doing honest-to-goodness legislative work and you want to be a partisan, to me, that's okay. To me, that's not unethical. It's just how do we guard the public trust there? To me, so I was trying to find limits. And so I'm open to discussion, Mr. Chairman. I know the amendment's before you. If it doesn't pass here, you may see it again. But I'm open to discussion on how to make that a better amendment.
And I thank you for that. I'll give you a few thoughts, and we'll see what the thoughts the committee has. It may be that we hold this amendment over. It may be better to hold it over, just a meeting to give people time to chew on it. But as I think, there may be some chance of us coming to common ground. But let me just share a couple thoughts, and I think I shared with them with you when you came to see me a day or so ago. First of all, I commend you for bringing the issue forward. It's it's a tricky area. It's an area where you can easily get crosswise with the public. The public is prone to distrust our motives and our actions, and so when you wade into this, you wade into a thicket. And I think when we met, I used the example of my telephone on my desk there. We operate here in a state building with resources that are paid for by the state. We can use those state resources for incidental personal use. If I need to speak to my wife, if I need to make a single copy of a single piece of paper that relates to my business or some part of my personal life, you can do that without running afoul of the ethics laws. But there's an absolute prohibition on using those state resources for campaign purposes. Mm-hmm. I can pick up the telephone and call my wife and ask her whether the car got dropped off or whether the rent got paid or collected. But what I can't say is I need to talk to my campaign manager and make sure he's gotten that filing or gotten that piece of literature done. I cannot use a state telephone to do that. It's a blanket prohibition, and I don't see that this would change that prohibition. And I totally am sympathetic to the Anchorage argument, we'll call it, because Anchorage is, to a large degree, at the center of business and political activity in the state, and frequently people are there doing legitimate state business, and there's incidental political activity that takes place. And I'm going to use the telephone as another example. If you're there in Anchorage on state paid travel from Fairbanks, and you get a phone call dealing with your campaign, can you take the phone call and deal with it or not? And I would say you absolutely can. There's nothing sort of special to your location involves the state paid travel in that phone call. And so that's sort of the area that I'm thinking of trying to carve out, that sort of makes it clear that if you need to go back to your hotel room and do some work on campaign emails, campaign website, whatever it is, that's not specific to the place you're in. But I'm having a harder time with the meetings, the lunches, the campaign events that you're in Anchorage for, or anywhere. Well, Juneau's another good a political town and fundraising town, and Fairbanks also. And so I'm struggling with that, and those are just some of the thoughts off the top of my head. And you can respond to them, or I can turn to other committee members.
I'll respond in one case. I'm sympathetic to that, because what if people travel to Fairbanks and are a special speaker at one of the lunches or an event in the evening, and yet they came up to meet with fish and game people? So I am sympathetic with it, but it just doesn't normally happen that way. And so then that's why if it's incidental to the travel is one of the standards that I think we can hold people accountable with. But anyway, so I am sympathetic with that. So don't get me wrong. I'm asking for an answer to a question that is tough for Alaska, big territory, and right now we all are anybody who doesn't live in the Anchorage area is almost always under a separate scrutiny that I think is unfair.
Senator Passman.
You know, what does the language incidental to the purpose of the travel mean? I mean, if someone flies into Anchorage, you have a half an hour meeting with a commissioner, but then you spend 3 hours in political activity.
Yeah.
Is the primary purpose of the travel something other than the half an hour meeting with the commissioner? Again, I mean, these are, you know, you can draw that line wherever you want, but what is incidental to the purpose of the travel mean?
Yeah, and I agree with you. Probably a criteria that I would use is, first, what is the primary reason for travel? And if you're using inordinate amount of time for political activity over that, it goes not only beyond incident, it goes beyond the 51%. So, I mean, that's the major reason then. So incidental falls way, way under that, in my view. In fact, I would even use the telephone example. It's something that you're going to run into, something you get invited to, something that is so small in time that it is small. So I actually put within our packet a definition of incidental. So I'll have to find that real quick. But I think I found a place where in one of our law definition books where I found that. And I will look that up because it's somewhere in here.
Oh, yeah, I have it. I have it actually behind my amendment. I've got a looks like I've got it in. It's got some interesting words in here. This is this a Black's Law Dictionary? Incidism. Include incident, incidental. I see it. Subordinate to something of greater importance, having a minor role. So I guess.
And Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
What my expectation is many times when an ethics charge has been brought, let's just say it brought against me because I spent time doing some political activity, people wanted to test that, and they brought it to the Ethics Committee. Many things that they deal with in the Ethics Committee are based on kind of a call on motive, on action, and this would give them a definition, I think, that gives them room within that sliding scale to say the action and the motive don't mix here. His motive was right, the action was wrong. We're going to maybe charge him for a time. But the motive was wrong, the action was wrong. We find an ethical problem here. Therefore, so I think we have to have a little discernment there, knowing how the Ethics Committee works. And if somebody has a legitimate ethical problem to bring forward, I think you have to have something like this that they can make that judgment call. So if you try to describe every circumstance, to me this incidental language probably is sufficient.
Senator Passman.
Yeah, and I tend to agree with Senator Coghill, and what has to be understood is that the law is establishing minimum standards of conduct. I think it's up to the individual legislator to establish their own higher personal standards of ethical conduct. And again, there is no bright line when you use the terminology incidental to the purpose of the travel. That can mean many different things to different people. But again, I think that's where it comes back to the individual legislator's personal ethics, whether they are at or lower than the minimum standard. That's where one potentially gets into trouble. If you establish personal ethical standards higher than that, then you never get to that low standard.
I agree. And Mr. Chairman, I'll give you one example. As a teacher, there was a time where I had one student helping the other, and the motive was exactly right, but they were helping him during a test. And that was the wrong time to do that. And they just missed that judgment call, and they had to be held accountable for it. And I think legislators quite often are in the same situation. They had every good motive, but they were just wrong. I think they need to be held accountable for that.
Right. Let me just ask our ethics guru, are there any rules in place right now that cover this? And by this I mean state paid travel, which is attended by campaign activity during the travel.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the Ethics Committee has had a discussion regarding this issue over the last 4 years, pretty much every year. And they have echoed what Senator Coghill has said, is that the statute is very clear that state resources cannot be used for campaigning. So if I were to receive a call from you, for instance, that you were going to be traveling to Fairbanks and there was going to be a fundraiser in the evening, and you asked if you could go, I would say you certainly could, but you couldn't do it on the state dime. So basically, there have been some individuals who have, you know, paid their own way to go to a particular legislative meeting so they could attend a fundraiser or a campaign event in the evening.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, and in my view, if you're using state resources, you shouldn't be going to a fundraiser. And so I wanted to have that very clear in here. But that is one of the questions that people keep asking.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we are politicians. We're citizen legislators. And if you're at work, let's just say as a lawyer, or if I was doing some construction work, maybe I go home. It's okay for me to go ahead and order things or look at blueprints or whatever. And if somebody walks into my office and asks me a bunch of political questions, I'm in violation.
Say that again.
If I go home on state travel, I do my business.
Go home. Juneau?
Yeah, I go home from Juneau to my house.
Okay.
I do the state business.
Right.
I go back to my office. I'm looking over some blueprints. People come
your
in.
State office?
Yeah. Okay. No, my home office.
Oh, okay.
But if I start getting engaged in political activity, mm-hmm. I could actually be had up if somebody in my office who was disgruntled with me said, that's not right. And because we say partisan political activity
right.
in our statute.
And is that defined? That phrase, Ms. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, partisan political activity is not defined. Right. There is a definition in state statute, I believe. I don't have that right in front of me, but I know the state statute does have a definition. I think Senator Coghill has looked at that definition before and maybe had some questions about it, if I remember correctly, but there is a definition in the state.
I think it begs the question, quite frankly. And I think this clarifies that question.
That's a fair example. All I wanted to do was work on oil taxes this session, but now you've given me this real serious puzzle to work on. We may have to hear from the committee at some point, the ethics committee. I have a hard time seeing them. While that may be a strict interpretation, you know, a campaign phone call that takes place while you're on state paid travel home, you know, is that partisan political activity?
If I could comment, Mr. Please. Chair, what the Ethics Committee has said, and it's we've actually put this in a newsletter that went out, I believe, last year, is that if the activity that is to be performed could only be performed because you were on that trip, well, then that is what is prohibited. If you are on a trip and you are in your hotel room, you know, waiting to go to another meeting the next day, you're not using state resources to make a phone call to your campaign manager or even to respond to a newspaper call regarding a campaign issue. So it's strictly if you were there for that purpose, and that is the only activity you could perform. And a couple examples would be door knocking in that particular area, dropping off leaflets, a fundraiser, or having a press conference, or in that area. Those are things that you could only do there versus doing it in another location.
I had jotted down here, not related to the physical location.
And exactly. That's basically
what I'm working on. And it doesn't take care of Senator Coghill's problem, but the door knocking example is a good one. You could finish a work day, a state paid, you know, trip to, you know, and this is for, I guess, more for rural legislators. You could get a state paid trip to a village for a meeting and go out and do some door knocking that evening.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just read you the section that begins this whole conduct and conflicts of interest. There's a lot of exceptions, and that's why we get into this question. But here is the overriding statute. Use of public funds, facilities, equipment, services, other government asset, which includes the travel, right, for non-legislative purpose, for involvement in or support of or opposition to partisan political activity for the private benefit of the legislator, legislative employer, or any other person. This paragraph, and then it goes on and talks about what it doesn't prohibit.
So it gives narrow exception, but I think the partisan political activity, I understand why we put it in there and why we have a whole laundry list of exceptions to that. But I think if you look at the exceptions when you're under state travel, the Ethics Committee has broadened its look at it because there are so many exceptions. But I think we need to be a little more explicit, because I think if you go to a luncheon, you're in danger. If you do work in a hotel room, that's one thing. So a lot of it is, how do you show up? Where do you show up? You know, I think we need to clarify that.
I don't know as. I agree it should be clarified, but I guess my question for Ms. Anderson is, without revealing any names, have legislators been found guilty of ethics violations for the sorts of things that Senator Cockrell's bringing up as examples, going to a luncheon, going to a meeting, maybe attending someone else's fundraiser?
To think about that one for a second.
Okay, that's fine. You can go back and check your records.
Any complaints that have come before the committee that are public documents, I can talk about.
That's fine.
There hasn't been one that has been issued on that particular subject. I do receive a lot of calls from legislators and legislative staff asking what they can and cannot do.
Just for clarity's purpose, they're not calling up and saying, hey, I saw so-and-so at a luncheon. Are they here on state travel? They're saying, can I do this? Can I do that?
That's correct. Okay. That doesn't mean that I haven't had those calls, but most often it's the legislator or the office calling. We did have legislator who maybe 3-4 years ago attended some campaign activities while on a week-long state paid trip, and the Ethics Committee, and this was public information, the Ethics Committee recommended that the individual pay back their airfare to and from, because that was the state resource that was used while they were there. So not necessarily a complaint, but a recommendation by the committee.
Right. You know, state paid travel, it's an interesting sort of concept as an asset. We all sort of know what it means, but it means it's taking me to a certain physical place. And so I guess, I'm just thinking out loud, but my own confines would be to say, if you're going to that place and the fundraiser's at that place or the luncheon's at that place and it's partisan political activity, that's the benefit. That's the advantage of the state paid travel, is to get you there. And it may not be your main purpose, but you're doing it. And just like I can't pick up a telephone and call my wife from my state office, just because I can't, by the same token that I can't call up my campaign manager and tell him to do something, I just don't know the public wants us to use state dollars that way. On the other hand, you know, if you're making phone calls, it doesn't matter where you make the phone call from, if you're doing emails, if you're fixing your website, if you're sending out an e-solicitation, whatever it is, that's not location dependent. And so the state paid travel is no advantage to you. It hasn't advanced your cause in any way, or advanced your opposition to a cause. So I guess those are the lines I'm thinking along.
And Mr. Chairman, I am sympathetic to that. I'm equally sympathetic to the guy that has to fly into town in order to meet whatever comrades he might have in a common philosophy. They can go do something. If he wants to do state business, they can go do state business. And then if that crowd of people decides to do some activity, he is the only one prohibited. I mean, there's a question, I think, of that that I've tried to find the balance to. To me, when we're fundraising, I understand that. You don't want to pay anybody to go fundraising. But you can't strip somebody of their partisan label, I think, just because they have traveled somewhere on state time.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think another thing to look at for us as we discuss this is sort of the advantage that you are given as a legislator versus, let's say, your challenger. Your challenger doesn't get a state paid trip into Anchorage or into Juneau for any sort of political partisan activity. Why should we be giving that to the incumbent? So I think that's another factor that needs to be placed in when we're sort of trying to figure out what's fair, what's ethical. We are giving advantages. You, like you said, it is location dependent, and a legislator who's on that paid trip to Anchorage or Fairbanks, their opponent or challenger doesn't get that same advantage. They don't get that paid trip.
That's a good point.
Mr. Chairman, I tend to agree with that, but the circumstances don't always allow that. For example, we have the same kind of an issue between Anchorage and everybody else outside of Anchorage in that they have an advantage, and should I start prohibitions on partisan political activity on those in Anchorage? Because that's kind of how you would balance that out. If during a legislative session they are free to not only do state business but political partisan activity, fundraising, et cetera, et cetera, should I start saying, there should be some prohibition there? So incumbents do have an advantage. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. And we have created a whole system of reporting and accountability measures. And that's the only way I could see it balancing out is put a whole bunch of accountability measures and responsibilities on those in the Anchorage area to kind of mitigate the disadvantage that so many other people have. I'll give you an example. There are some places in Alaska, in order to get to Anchorage, it may take a full day and night's meeting, or traveling, for a variety of reasons, plane schedules and or distance. I understand that. If I flew to Anchorage primarily for a fundraiser, I would expect to pay on my own dime, fly back to Fairbanks, and fly back to finish other business. I can appreciate that. That's a hardship, but that's part of, But I don't know why it's a or a violation of public trust for somebody to stand up with a philosophical group that they care about, and it happens to be a partisan issue, and it's incidental to their state travel. I don't see where that's that big of a problem. It's not a violation of public trust. Now it can become a violation of public trust. I understand that, probably in my view, I always try to look at the statutes and the ethics code as we want to hold you accountable, but I don't want to get to a place where we assume everybody's bad. I just want to have an accountability measure. And so that's why I thought having this criteria of incidental only during certain times of the day or allowing for the actual day, a normal work day, not during or before an election, and no fundraising. To me, that made it so clear, because what we're doing now is people are asking questions a lot. It's true. Probably there hasn't been a lot of charges, but I think it's potential for that. And it's not clear. That's the thing. To me, rule of law should be what's clear. And our ethics code is complex enough as it is. This helps clarify it. So, however, being sympathetic to some of the arguments, I'm looking for ways to help clarify it. If the amendment fails, then the question goes unanswered, and believe me, it's going to come back around somewhere. The Ethics Committee, unfortunately, is the one that have legislators come and say, that's not fair. And they say, well, go to the statutes and find a way to fix it. And I've already been told that there's at least some bravery involved in asking the question. So I've already got one bad headline out of it. We'll see if we can get another one.
I don't wish you any bad headlines. They tend to come whether you want them or not. I guess I would just clarify that you mentioned legislative session, but I don't think we're trying to open up. And we all know we can't raise money, for example, during a legislative session. That's a blanket that applies to all of us. And you mentioned holding Anchorage legislators to the same prohibition, but I think that's an example that's a little off. Anchorage challengers meet Anchorage incumbents, and they're sort of playing on the same level playing field. it doesn't behoove me to pay to go travel somewhere, use state paid travel to take me someplace when the votes that I need and much of the funds I need are in Anchorage. It's a little bit. I mean, I understand your point. It's in that Anchorage legislators sort of enjoy an advantage when it comes to, frankly, raising money. I mean, the votes can only be where the votes are, but they're running against other opposite numbers from the same area. It's, I think Senator Wilikowski has pointed out and made a good point. A Fairbanks incumbent has a big advantage over a Fairbanks challenger. That Fairbanks incumbent can use state paid travel to come to Anchorage, do some state business, and you've got a blanket prohibition on fundraising, and that's good. And so maybe as we work through it, we can come to a place where we're comfortable. I guess we're sort of getting short on time. But I guess my question back is, what's the exact? You've said a couple times I want to not prohibit someone from standing with people with whom they're philosophically aligned. Or I don't want to prohibit them from going to a luncheon. Is that what you're? I mean, you're not saying I want the guy to be able to go to a fundraiser because you ruled that out.
No, but I carry my philosophy very openly, and that draws invitations to go speak or be a participant. And if I go to the Chamber of Commerce, nobody has a problem with that. But if I go speak to a bunch of Republicans, and I happen to be on state travel, it seems to be a problem. So that's one issue. And I actually ran into it. My district has the Richardson Highway, so in order to visit Valdez and Glen Allen and go on over to Palmer and then back, it's a two-day trip. If I am asked to stop in at Delta on the way back and address, say, a Republican group, ethically, I'm not going to do it because I don't think our statutes have a clarity, and I'm not going to open myself up to that. But it's a shame.
And I guess just for the purposes of discussion, you're an honest and trustworthy human being, and so I can't imagine you running afoul of this. But I guess I can't imagine another person saying, "Great, I can fly to Anchorage, I can go to a Republican luncheon." And I can't actually fundraise, but I can say, I guess you get into some very interesting First Amendment questions about what you can and cannot say at that luncheon. Can you say you should be giving more to the Republican Party? You should give it tomorrow. Don't give it today because I can't fundraise now, but you should write a big fat check tomorrow. And you can see where that just would.
There's going to be bad people in the world everywhere. I guess that's my basic philosophy, is we live in a world where we're supposed to be free people, and then when we do wrong, we're held accountable.
Yeah.
But in our ethics law, we can start becoming so prescriptive that people are really not free unless the administrative law says they can do that. And I kind of chide against that. I rebel against that because I want to be a free person that's held accountable for bad behavior.
I'm not sure that free people have access to the state treasury.
I agree. That's why I say the balance between the public trust and your ability to be the person that you are.
If you want to be a free person, it's easy. You resign this job and you go, speak, write, talk, agitate. Right. But, we're given a public trust, and one of those things is the access to state dollars, which people take very, very seriously.
But to say you must not be partisan, I think becomes a problem.
I agree. There's a definite rub in there. And so I I'll thank you for bringing this a very thorny issue and very entertaining issue to our attention. If there's nothing else to come before the committee, I would like to hold the amendment open and not force a vote on it. Thank you, Senator Coghill. And unless there's something else to come before the committee, thank you all for being at this kickoff session. We are adjourned.